Majority Report with Sam Cedar, where every day's casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday, Tuesday, casual Tuesday, Wednesday, casual hump day, Thursday, casual Thurs, that's what we call it, and Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Friday, October 16th, 2020. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps and steps and steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Trump and Biden, dueling town halls, maintaining the narrative of Donald Trump being a lunatic and Joe Biden not being a lunatic. U.S. tops 60,000 daily coronavirus infections. 44 states see infections on the rise. The Coney Barrett hearings end, and they end with calls for Dianne Feinstein to resign as the Democratic leader of the Judiciary Committee. Also on the program today, other Dems vow what sauce for the goose is sauce for the gander. White House has been warned that Rudy Giuliani was the target of a foreign misinformation scam. Meanwhile, Rudy's daughter has been saying the whole time, "Don't listen to my dad." Chris Christie is out of the ICU. He says mea culpa when it comes to masks. And as the economy slowly sinks, more data shows the CARES Act payments end have left Americans in desperate times. Donald Trump rejects California's request for wildfire aid. Kamala Harris cancels weekend campaign travel. As two cases of coronavirus pop up amongst her remote staff. White House seeks to block public transportation grants to anarchist jurisdictions. All that and more. Oh, including Ben Dixon and David Rees and his co-hosts from the Election Profit Makers podcast. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Thank you for joining us, ladies and gentlemen. It is Casual Friday. For those of you who are watching, you can see I am wearing a soft collar shirt, as is tradition around here. Casual Fridays. I don't maintain the normal decorum that I do over the course of the week, although I have shaved to round out the week. We are now 18 days away from, you know, it's funny for, I've been doing this now professionally for 16 years. In fact, the 10-year anniversary of this program will fall on Election Day, of this iteration of the program. And in that time, there has been four presidential elections, 2004, 2008, 12, 16, and now 20. And, you know, we hear this all the time. This election is the most consequential of our times. I feel like I'm hearing it less these days because everybody believes it. It is. It's going to be hugely consequential. Its outcome, from my perspective, will either be unimaginably dire for the country, or vastly, vastly necessary and totally insufficient. And part of what we're going to talk about is what we're starting to hear a little bit is the pushes that are coming from the left for Joe Biden, and not just from the left. I mean, imagine from a lot of different forces, actually. There's going to be a huge competition for Joe Biden's time and efforts and disposition following, well, it's already started. And we had Bernie Sanders the other day was saying it's he believes the progressives should hold their fire for the next 2 weeks and then aggressively begin to lobby the Biden transition campaign or apparatus and whatnot. And in fact, that lobbying is already going on. And I think it's scaring some people, to be honest with you. We will talk more about that in a bit. But let's wrap up what we were talking about for most of this week, which was the Amy Coney Barrett hearings. Next week on the program, we will have the executive director of Demand Justice, Brian Fallon, on, in part because he is one of those organizations that have been calling for the resignation of Dianne Feinstein. And what we are seeing shape up in the Senate, or I should say the resignation from her position as the Democratic leader in the Judiciary Committee. I would personally call for her total resignation, but I think that's probably a bridge too far. And here is why. There was basically two visions of how the Democrats should perceive and deal with Republicans in the event that Joe Biden wins the election and that the Democrats take the Senate. Exhibit A is Sheldon Whitehouse basically telling the Republicans that this committee process, this nomination has been a sham. And like I said, what is sauce for the goose is sauce for the gander. Here's Sheldon Whitehouse in his in the closing day of the Amy Coney Barrett hearings.
Republican members on this committee, of whom I am very fond. But don't think that when you have established the rule of because we can, that should the shoe be on the other foot, you will have any credibility to come to us and say, yeah, I know you can do that, but you shouldn't because of X, Y, or Z. Your credibility to make that argument at any time in the future will die in this room and on that Senate floor if you continue to proceed in this way. I hope that that is not the case. But please don't think that they're two separate rules, that when there is Republican majority, the rule is because we can, and when there is a Democrat majority, the rule is, oh, no, you can't do it that way.
So there is Sheldon Whitehouse's vision, which is basically, look, that we are playing by a different set of rules now. You have established them, and we are going to play by those rules. And that is a vision that is in competition with one, if not explicitly expressed by Dianne Feinstein, implicitly. I want you to look at this clip. I understand. There's also, understand what was going on in this hearing. The hearing itself was a sham. The idea that it was rushed in this way, particularly based upon the rules that established an empty seat in 2016 by Mitch McConnell, this was a sham process. In addition to that, you had multiple members of that committee who refused to either get a test or to publicly announce what their test results were when you had other members of that committee who had been infected by a disease that is running rampant in our country right now. Third is the political implications of number two and number one, and the fact that the chair of this committee, Lindsey Graham, is in the most competitive race of his Senate career. against a Democrat who has raised an extraordinary amount of money, who has done an incredible amount of work. Jamie Harris, not necessarily going to be my favorite Democrat if he becomes the senator. But nevertheless, from there, just like strictly from a partisan standpoint, remember these three things. When you hear Dianne Feinstein now, flush all of them down the toilet, all of those political narratives, perhaps costing the Democrats control of the Senate in 4 months. Listen to this.
Yes, ma'am.
Mr. Chairman, I just want to thank you. This has been one of the best set of hearings that I've participated in. And I want to thank you for your fairness and the opportunity of going back and forth. It leaves one with a lot of hopes, a lot of questions, and even some ideas of perhaps some good bipartisan legislation we can put together to make this great country even better. So thank you so much for your leadership.
I would bet you everything I own that if that has not already been cut into an ad for Lindsey Graham, who is trying to sort of split the difference between being a suck up to Donald Trump all this time and still appealing to Republican so-called moderates or suburban voters. If that's not been cut up as an ad already, I guarantee you it will be. It is astonishing. Astonishing that she would do that. Particularly, that entire hearing was a sham. It should not have happened. She has already announced that if she is chair of the Judiciary Committee, that she will honor blue slips, which is exactly what Patrick Leahy did, which is exactly why Donald Trump will see 215 or 220 federal judges to lifetime appointments, because the Republicans held up dozens upon dozens of judicial nominees because of the use of those blue slips, which is just a favor you do to the opposing party. Mitch McConnell did not extend that same favor over the past 4 years, but Dianne Feinstein wants to get in and reimpose that. This is universal. It's beyond surrender. I don't care what your politics are. If you're a member of the Democratic Party or you feel it necessary to vote for Democrats this time around so that Donald Trump does not retain power and so that Republicans do not retain power, Dianne Feinstein has fundamentally undercut your efforts. It is astonishing. And this is not a senator from West Virginia. This is not a senator who somehow snuck in from North Dakota. This is a senator from the bluest state in the entire country, from a state where the Republican Party does not exist, whose competition in the general election last time was a Democrat. It's insanity. It's insanity. And it is incumbent upon Chuck Schumer, who is ostensibly the leader of the Democrats in the Senate, to deal with this. Because if Dianne Feinstein is the chair of the Judiciary Committee going into a Biden administration, it's almost no different as if Lindsey Graham remains so. I mean, it's really stunning, because she will leave open the door for the next Republican president to fill tens upon tens of seats. It really is. I do not hold Dianne Feinstein in terribly high regard, and I was still shocked by that.
It was shocking how bad it was, but people were specifically worried about Feinstein going into this too.
Yep. Well, she blew the first Amy Coney Barrett hearing. She blew it and completely handcuffed the Democrats for this one. The only option they had was to not go in there, and I am convinced that she wanted to be able to do what she did, and that's why they went in there. It's just unbelievable. Meanwhile, just a reminder, it's your support that makes this show possible, and by becoming a member of the program, you support the free show, and then you get the bonus content every day. And don't forget, the Noma Key Show is on at 3 p.m. today. Her guest, Brianna Westbrook, Kate Albright, Hannah, Jamie Augustin. You can check that show out at 3 p.m. on YouTube. And today's program is sponsored by one of my favorite sponsors, Sunset Lake CBD. Right now, Sunset Lake CBD is harvesting their 2020 crop. Everything is hand harvested. Everything is hand processed by a team of trained harvest specialists. And I will say this, I'm really proud about this. I mentioned the other day, I got a really nice letter from them. With the help of Majority Report listeners who have been loving Sunset Lake's CBD's like wide range of products, the team has grown from less than 10 people in 2019 to more than 20 people in 2020. They have a $15 minimum wage. They are fair-paying agricultural and manufacturing jobs in rural Vermont. And also, one of the things they do is they work with the University of Vermont on regenerative farming practices. And I was asking, like, you know, tell us more what that means. Well, it means reducing and eliminating harmful pesticides, herbicides, and fungicides. They reduce or eliminate the use of outside chemical fertilizers. They're cutting down on water usage. They also are reducing and eliminating heavy tilling, which apparently, you know, where you till the ground, where you dig it up and this and that, which also sort of diminishes the all the minerals and nutrients in the soil. They're doing cover cropping and seasonal crop rotation. They switch which piece of land they're going to be growing on in 2021, allow the land to sort of regenerate over the course of 2 or 3 years. When you grow a monocrop on one a piece of land for too many seasons, everybody knows it begins to permanently disable, essentially, the soil. And we can't have that because good dirt, good soil is hugely important for our environment. And their product is amazing. And Matt, you're going to be excited about this. They're going to be unveiling new strains in mid-November for their smokables, including hand-trimmed flower smalls, Matt, and Keef. Some strains to anticipate are Spec 7, Sour Special Sauce, and Super Sour Space Candy. I don't know what any of that means, but everybody who tries the smokables that I personally know have been loving them. For me, I'm a big tincture guy. They've got multiple doses of tincture, which help me sleep. The salve has been great for me on my eczema. I don't know if it would work for you on that, but I know that people have said that it's helped with their aches and pains. It's got arnica in it and beeswax, and there are gummies, and they have a CBD-infused coffee. And if you head over to sunsetlakecbd.com and use the coupon code LEFTISBEST, one word, LEFTISBEST, they'll give you 20% off. Check it out, folks. They're a great company. Great product. It's turned me from a skeptic into somebody who uses the product regularly, I got to tell you. So check it out. Meanwhile, joining us now, we have Ben. Yes, we have proprietor of the Benjamin Dixon program. Ben Dixon is here with us. Ben, welcome to the show.
Sam, thanks for having me, man. Appreciate you always.
So, all right, there's a lot of stuff I want to talk about. I set up the show earlier with clips of the end of the Amy Coney Barrett hearing. And I want to get into the town halls last night and, you know, talk about how that maybe have changed a little bit of the narrative, but I don't think it did, really, to be honest with you. But there are a couple of things that changed in terms of where Joe Biden sits. But I want to look a little past the election at first, right, to a struggle that I think we're going to see. I mean, there was a piece in Politico today by Alex Thompson, AOC House Progressives warn Biden on corporate hires. Now, this to me sounds like whenever you read something in Politico, right, there's always like you're seeing the shadow of something, it seems to me. Stories like this, I should say, right, which is, somebody wants a narrative out there right now,
right,
that they think is going to help their cause. And the nature of this story is that is a little bit of like people are worried that the left may be getting out ahead of their skis on this et cetera, et cetera. It reads a little bit like there's an argument that maybe the left should trim their sails in pushing Biden. Now, of course, the reality is everyone's pushing Biden. Everybody's trying to get a seat at the table, and everybody's trying to get their personnel in to define what Joe Biden does as president, if that happens. And there's two different dispositions towards a lot of this in terms of the Republicans, broadly speaking, which I think was evidenced between those two clips I just played, one between White House and Dianne Feinstein. Give me your sense of how this is shaking out to the extent that we can see it, right? Because a lot of this is sort of obscured from public view right now, and obviously is secondary to the actual election. But these are the things, you know, people remember what happened with Obama in 2008.
Yes. Yeah. No, I remember that. That's the thing I remember the most was one of his first hires was Timothy Geithner over at Treasury. And that's when I knew the jig was up. Right. All the hope and change kind of died inside of me at that moment. But we have the full expectation. I think the left, we have the full expectation that this is the direction that a Biden administration is going to go. And I agree with you. This is secondary to November 3rd. Right. We would rather fight neoliberalism than neofascism. So, but we do understand what we're getting. I like the way that you put it. Like, this is perhaps in the political piece, they're trying to tell us to get in line already. But the thing is, we're coming with a totally different attitude. I can't speak on behalf of AOC or anybody else on the left, obviously. But I think there's a general sentiment on the left is that we're going to do you guys a solid. We're going to do America a solid. We're going to help you get rid of the fascists that your policies, quite frankly, help bring into power. But once we've done that, please understand that you're next. We're coming for you. You can give us a seat at the table if you like, that's fine, but we're coming to take the table in the long run. But we do realize that right now, all hands on deck to get rid of Donald Trump.
I think that captures it quite a bit. And you mentioned Geithner, and it was, I think, like after the fact that we realized that one of his key transition figures was this guy Froman, who ended up being his top trade negotiator and was the one who was developing the PPP. And I don't know, it feels like a million years ago, but and PPP was, you know, of the myriad of reasons why Hillary Clinton lost, Barack Obama pushing the PPP so heavily towards the end of his administration was certainly something that cost Hillary Clinton in some ways. I mean, you know, we know there was a huge cauldron of reasons.
TPP.
And it's hard to disaggregate. But Froman had a list. And Froman, yeah. I should say, was a former Citibank executive. He was a Robert Rubin acolyte. And had a list that was generated presumably amongst his, you know, that group of people as to who Barack Obama should be putting into positions. And, you know, I can't remember when the reporting came out on that list. It was years later. And it was almost a one-to-one relationship between that list generated out of Citibank and who was going to fill a lot of the major cabinet positions and sub cabinet positions, I should say, in the Obama administration. So this is what's so weird about this, Ben. This is a hugely important time. Like right now, in the run up to the election, of course, first order issue is get rid of Donald Trump. But the thing is that there is a whole host of people who are working on the second order issue and who have the luxury, literally, or the resources to do that. And everything that's happening literally right now in terms of the Biden transition team. And that's going to happen starting November 4th. Mm-hmm. I mean, knock on wood, or November 8th, knock on wood, or November 10th, or, you know, God help us, January December. 19th. I mean, there is a transition that is going on that is going to define what happens in the first 2 years of the Biden presidency. And we know from experience with Obama that is the one where you're going to see the most change. We know we saw it with Trump, too. That's when the major tax cuts passed. To the extent that there is going to be any major signature legislation that is passed. It's going to happen during that era, that first couple of years. And these are the people who are going to sit in there. And we have no access to it. I mean, it's sort of very frustrating in some way. We don't have the ability to push that right now.
Right. You know, one thing I want to point out, though, Sam, is I agree with what you're saying. But I think it's important that we start looking at this in terms of holistic cycles. We were caught off guard by Obama's administration those first 2 years. Matter of fact, the first 2 weeks, we had more expectations of his administration than we probably should have. But no, let me correct that. We were right to have those expectations. But the position that we were in, we didn't have the institutional power that we have now. We don't have as much as we need, the left, progressives, but we sure as hell have a whole lot more than we had in 2008. And so I think we're in a kind of semi-power position. We're not able to call the shots, but it would be folly for them to keep the more progressive wing of the party at bay in favor of, the Lincoln Project style Republicans who are going to need to find a new home. It would be extremely foolhardy for them to do that, because it's not as though we're going to be left out in the cold. It's not as though them isolating us from this process and from those positions and from that influence silences us. Oh, no, it just gives us more ammunition to bring them hell. And I'm quite frankly really excited about that, because I've been quiet for the last 5 months or however long this journey has been. And I've got a lot to say, and so do so many other people. They should negotiate with us, because they should want to bring us in versus have us on the outs.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I watched what happened in that Senate hearing at the end of yesterday. This is at the end of the Amy Coney Barrett hearing. And there was a lot of soliloquies, by the senators. And there was, and then we had this thing with Ben Sasse yesterday, where he leaks out. I mean, this was not by accident that we know this, where Ben Sasse is trying to distance himself. There is a feeling that I got when I watched that stuff, that sort of like sickly feeling that I had from years ago, that you have elements of the Democratic Party who are already trying to build coalitions with Republicans across the table. And the Republicans are doing it because they need to reform themselves after what they have done over the past four, really, I mean, more years, but certainly this past 4 years have been reprehensible, and they need to reform themselves. And you see the Democrats not just giving them a life, a life preserver, but also building coalitions as a way of blocking and needing the progressive wing less, right? I mean, because this is about addition in many respects. And, you know, I'm looking at this political story, and the difference, you're right. I mean, there's two differences, it seems to me, between 2020 and 2008. And that is, in 2008, we didn't have an AOC. We didn't have something like Justice Democrats who were challenging primary challenges. We didn't have, you know, what happened in 2018, where you knocked off a couple of, and by AOC, I mean, not just what she's saying, but what she represents in terms of a challenge to the Democratic leadership. And like you say, we didn't have the skepticism of Obama. That is,
you're naive.
I mean, it couldn't be more the opposite at this point, right? I mean, it's like everyone is voting for Joe Biden with their eyes wide open, with the lowest of expectations and with the highest expectations that we need to engage. And remember, the Obama campaign had completely neutered all the outside groups to the extent that they existed. With that, they basically told all their donors, you don't give to these outside groups.
Right.
You give to us, and we handle it. And so this is a very different time. And I think just even like pointing out this stuff creates a certain pressure on Biden at all.
Yeah. No, I did two totally different episodes this week. One episode, I was kind of disillusioned, and I'm like, we're going to have to play an even longer game. We may be on the outs talking about progress in general, the Democratic Party in general, in context of Amy Coney Barrett. Like, maybe we should be projecting 30 or 40 years out. But then the next day it came to me in a conversation I was having with Jonathan Smucker, who is an activist, that we're on the ascendancy here. Like, we can't take it for granted. We can't belittle this or look down on the fact that, yeah, we lost two primaries back to back, but they had to throw themselves on the sword, on their swords, the neoliberal wing. They had to throw themselves on their swords in order to stop us in 2020. And so as bleak as this looks, there are people in positions of power with fundraising capacity, with larger fundraising capacity than some of the top Democrats in this country, yep. With larger email lists than the top Democrats in this country, with larger media platforms than all the Democrats in this country, that we're just simply waiting for them to act stupid, because we really have it out for them. In a way that they can't imagine. We would rather work with them. No, that's not even true. Some of us are waiting to fight them. So it would behoove them to catch us on the ascendancy and make some changes if they want moderate changes, because we're coming for progressive change, whether they like it or not.
Let's play this clip from, you know, like I say, the two town halls last night, the dueling town halls. And apparently more people watched the Joe Biden town hall, yep, than Donald Trump, which I think really must hurt Donald Trump's feelings.
Donald Trump. Yeah.
But look, we went into this last night with the narrative of Donald Trump is a raving lunatic and Joe Biden is not Donald Trump. Right. I mean, that's the proposition from the Biden campaign in many respects.
Yeah.
And I think if you look at the coverage and you look at what happened in these town halls, that's basically what everybody came out of it with. But this I found interesting. Here is Joe Biden. I'm not going to play the whole clip. We'll play a part of it. He's asked about the 94 crime bill. And we are 3 weeks out from an election. And, you know, this is not the primary.
Right.
Joe Biden understands at the very least, and I don't know how, you know, it's just words, but when a politician says certain things, that means they're trying to protect their flank. And if they feel a certain weakness in some area, that means that there's probably a weakness there. And so that's where you push. And here's Joe Biden talking about that 94 crime bill. And my feeling is the first time we've heard anything like this from him.
Meantime, an awful lot of people were jailed for minor drug crimes after the
exactly
crime.
Right.
Was it a mistake to support it?
Yes, it was. But here's where the mistake came. The mistake came in terms of what the states did locally. What we did federally, we said it was, and you remember, George, it was all about the same time for the same crime. What I had done as chairman of the Judiciary Committee, I took the 10 circuit courts of appeals, took some really brilliant lawyers working for me in judiciary. We did a study. And we determine what happens if for the first, second, third offense for any crime in the criminal justice system at the federal level. If you're a black man, it's the first time you committed robbery. How long would you go to jail on average? If you're a white man, how long? Black man would go to jail on average 13 years. White man, 2 years. I go down the list of every single crime. So we set up a sentencing commission. We didn't set the time. Every single solitary maximum was reduced in there. But what happened was it became the same time for the same crime. So it said you have to serve between 1 and 3 years. They ended up becoming much lower. Black folks went to jail a lot less than they would have before, but it was a mistake.
Let me ask another follow-up.
Now, I don't think he did a great job necessarily of explaining that, but he's at least trying to. But more importantly, he disavowed the 94 crime bill. And that's an interesting thing. I mean, I can imagine a Joe Biden going, it wasn't a mistake. It was other people's fault. But he said it was a mistake. And I think that and then, you know, a quarter or I don't know, 50 cents will get you a phone call these days. But it's still better than if he had answered in a different way.
Yeah. I have mixed feelings about the 94 crime bill debate. I'm very clear on the 94 crime bill. Of course, it was something that I happily weaponized during the primaries because he needed to answer for it. But at the same time, I think it's a weapon now being wielded by people who would happily and giddily do even more damage to the black community and to minority communities. So the disingenuousness of it, to me, it reeks. And the fact that Joe Biden waited this long to disavow it in the same, in the way that he did, you know, that's just bad politics, right? That's not only like bad judgment, but that's really bad politics. So I'm glad he's finally come around to it. But by the time he came around to it, like, I've moved on past it, right? And I think more people need to move on past it, because at this point it's in the hands. It, when it's a debate between the progressive wing of the Democratic Party, Bernie Sanders, who openly spoke out against those aspects in 94 against Joe Biden, that's one thing, because we have Bernie Sanders on the record being against the very things that came into fruition. When it's a debate between Joe Biden and the Republican Party, I'm not even concerned about the 94 crime bill anymore, because I know if Republicans have their way, they will double down on it in 2020.
Right. That's a good point. I found it interesting that he did that. And I wonder, you know, at this juncture, I wonder what, you know, maybe it's just a genuine feeling on some level, or maybe there's some indication that, like, he needs to give this to the left. I mean, I don't know. Go ahead.
To that point, you're right. Like, that's the political side. The politics side of it is, yeah, man, you should have been on top of this a long time ago. Like, you saw this coming in the primaries, and it represents a level of stubbornness that is kind of present in most politicians. But it is almost though he's trying to stop the hemorrhaging, and I think he can. But in terms of like the sincerity of either side of the equation at this point, I mean, it's all political theater, and I don't know how much it's going to move the dial one way or the other. Because I think even the Black community and anyone who was affected or moved by the 94 crime bill, I think that's already baked in as well.
Yeah, I think one of the things that his answer provides is just more, I guess, fodder for the idea that Joe Biden is a normal politician. He is going to actually look at the issues and have some set of reasoning for things.
Right.
And I think, you know, that's been the Biden strategy throughout this, is like, we're not going to make any waves. We're just going to try and convince people that you can go back to some form of normalcy. When you turn on your TV or your radio, the top story isn't that, you know, Donald Trump has lit the world on fire or something. Here is Joe Biden, however, talking about climate change. And this is really stunning. When you think this week, we just saw Amy Coney Barrett say, like, I don't have any thoughts on the reality of climate change. Like, seriously?
Seriously.
But here is Joe Biden highlighting one aspect of that is problematic in regarding climate change.
And make a lot of money doing it. For example, right now down in people, when I say that, they wonder what I'm talking about. The biggest carbon sink in the world is the Amazon. More carbon absorbed from the air, diminishing global warming in the Amazon, than all the carbon emitted on a yearly basis from the United States of America, from all vehicles and all means. So we have to use our imaginations. We have to move in the direction as well, providing for electric vehicles. Electric vehicles will save billions of gallons of oil, create, estimated, not me, Wall Street, 1 million automobile jobs. But we're lagging, I mean, we're not investing. We're not doing any of the research.
Got to take another quick break.
I mean, so there it is, you know, and again, like, he's, I wouldn't say this is the most, you know, cohesive response to global warming. I mean, he's sort of dancing around a little bit, but he's at least bringing up like concepts that are relevant to the issue. He's obviously acknowledging its existence. It's interesting. There was a study that came out the other day that said, if we were to be able to return like 1/3 of the world's farmland to the wild, essentially create forests from it, that we would go a long way to dealing with climate change, just by creating more carbon sink, essentially, basically the functional equivalent of like a dump for carbon. I don't know how else to express it in an easy way. And so he's talking about this, and you have people tuning into that, that town hall, they're getting exactly what the Biden narrative is. Like, a guy who, you know, is sort of technocratic a little bit. I mean, like, just what we expect out of a politician, right? Like, just sort of like has ideas how to fix things.
Right. two things, man. Again, when you compare it to Amy Coney Barrett, like you said, like, yeah, thank you. I appreciate it, Joe Biden. Like, and when you compare it to Donald Trump, I'm like, yeah, I appreciate the possibility of waking up one morning without existential dread because the president is pushing us over the edge into the abyss, like having fun doing it from his golden toilet that I'm sure he had transported down to the White House. Like, I really look forward to a day where we don't have a news cycle that one day of a news cycle that normally would take up a month. In any normal times. That said, when you compare it to the what has to be done, it's still in and of itself insufficient, which isn't to attack him. Like I said, I appreciate him compared to Amy Coney Barrett. Thank you. But in terms of what needs to be done, in terms of what's being proposed from the left, I think this goes back to the first part of our conversation. It would behoove them to bring us to the table and not try to distance themselves so much from the Green New Deal, because quite frankly, the Green New Deal is incremental in its own way. And so it's not tenable in the long run for a Joe Biden style policy to help solve solutions, because we'll run out of time, quite frankly. But if we let these other monsters stay in power, then our time frame is going to be even shorter and we won't be able to get anything done. So I look at Joe Biden as a stopgap measure. What he was saying on the rainforest is absolutely accurate. And in a way, it is a brilliant stopgap measure, but we got to go beyond that. So let's stop the bleeding with Joe Biden and his piecemeal haphazard. I think haphazard is unfair, but half-assed is not unfair measures. And then we have to make a pivot towards the right direction, which is the left.
I almost think that his measures are three-quarter ass. But regardless, the thing that is exciting is that in the event that the Democrats take control of the Senate and the House and the presidency, the debate is not going to be between Joe Biden's proposal and whether climate change is real or we just need to leave it to a deity to solve. It's going to be between Joe Biden's plan and then the Green New Deal. So our solution is more than likely going to end up somewhere in between there, which is better than it ending up somewhere over here or not non-existent whatsoever.
Yeah.
All right, let's flip the channel, as it were, as if we were in real time. Hey, we just heard Joe Biden talk about the, talk about the dynamic of carbon and sinking. Let's tune in to see what Donald Trump is talking about. Oh, he's pretending he doesn't know what QAnon is. Let's look at this.
Down our cities that are run by Democrats who don't know what
they're doing. While we're denouncing, let me ask you about QAnon. It is this theory that Democrats are a satanic pedophile ring and that you are the savior of that. Now, can you just once and for all state that that is completely not true and disavow QAnon in its entirety?
I know nothing about QAnon.
I just told you.
I know very little. You told me, but what you tell me doesn't necessarily make it fact. I hate to say that. I know nothing about it. I do know they are very much against pedophilia. They fight it very hard, but I know nothing about it.
They believe it is a satanic cult run by the deep state.
Study the subject. I'll tell you what I do know about. I know about Antifa, and I know about the radical left, and I know how violent they are and how vicious they are, and I know how they're burning down cities run by Democrats, not run by Republicans.
Republican Senator Ben Sasse said, quote, QAnon is nuts, and real leaders call conspiracy theories conspiracy theories.
He may be
right. Why not just say it's crazy and not true?
He may be right. I just don't know about QAnon.
You do know.
I don't know. No, I don't know. I don't know.
Let me ask you another thing.
Let's waste a whole show. You start off with white supremacy. I denounce it. You start off with something else. Let's go. Keep asking me these questions.
Okay.
Let me just tell you what I do hear about it is they are very strongly against pedophilia. And I agree with that. I mean, I do agree with that. And I agree
but
with
there's
it.
There's not
very
a
strongly.
Satanic pedophile.
I have no idea.
By.
I know
you
nothing
don't
about
know that.
That.
Okay.
No, I don't know.
You
that.
Just
and neither,
this
and neither
week.
Do you know that?
Okay, just this week.
Why aren't you asking me about Antifa? Why aren't you asking me about the radical left?
Because you're volunteering.
Why aren't you asking Joe Biden questions about why doesn't he condemn Antifa? Why does he say it doesn't exist?
Because you're
Antifa,
here before
me. Antifa, no, so cute. Antifa exists. They're vicious.
And Dixon. Your sense of how much Donald Trump knows about QAnon?
I would argue that Donald Trump spends time on QAnon websites because, you know, I have to actually say something. I have known for some time that Donald Trump isn't as dumb as he pretends to be. But what I saw in that exchange, I actually have to commend him on being intellectually nimble to play this game. Now, don't get me wrong. It's intellectually dishonest. And this is what a con man is able to do. They're able to spin on a dime easily. That's how they get their con accomplished. But I think it goes to show how calculating he is. The way he pivoted on those questions, held the line. It's a classic thing that a con man does, but it should show every single American, particularly Democrats in Washington, D.C., that Donald Trump is cold, meticulous, and calculating on every single thing that he does. And we've given him the benefit of the doubt to say, oh, he's such a moron. No, actually, he's not. He is a calculating, narcissistic sociopath who will burn this country to the ground. And he's not willing to distance himself from QAnon because he knows exactly how much. He knows enough about them to know that they're a core part of his constituency.
Yeah, I found it sort of fascinating that he could have just said, like, I know nothing about them and end it right there. And when she was about to pivot, he said, but I do know against pedophilia.
Yes. Like, so he gives them a bone, right? He gives them something to latch onto. When you have supporters, what they need from you more than anything else is just give us anything. Don't abandon us completely. If you just give us one thing, we'll forgive everything else bad that you said about us. So the white supremacists that he quote unquote denounced, you know, they are still hanging on, stand ready and stand by, right? Or stand back and stand by. They're clinging on to that because they want to support him and they think that he has to make these denunciations, which he has to do. So that's what he's doing. When he say, I know they're against pedophilia, and they're all cheering and rejoicing because they're like, yes, we're against pedophilia. Never mind the fact that we ignore the fact that Donald Trump had a really good relationship with Jeffrey Epstein.
Yeah, the right has always been good about this. Rush Limbaugh many times will say, like, no, of course he's got to deny, you know, not in this instance about QAnon, but generally the idea of like, of course he's got to deny because he'll get roasted by the mainstream media, but he clearly is with us on blah blah. That exactly. is that construct is pretty common. All right, we're gonna take just a quick break. And when we come back, get another clip of Donald Trump I want to play you. Did you know, Ben, and we will discuss this when we return, that Donald Trump has a healthcare plan for us? It's pretty exciting.
Just like his plan for Black America.
Okay. So, Ben, I mentioned just before we took that quick break that Donald Trump has a plan for healthcare in America. And, you know, this is where I feel like he could have been pushed just a little bit more by Savannah Guthrie. I mean, there was enough of enough was communicated that the administration is pursuing the end of Obamacare. And I think, you know, fortunately for Democrats, the race is not in a month or two, because I think the whole pre-existing conditions thing, the Republicans have finally figured out a way of dealing with that. And, you know, that being the surrogate for the entire Obamacare, the expansion of Medicaid, the whole patient protection rights. But here is Trump answering a question about healthcare.
With pre-existing conditions, and I can't say that more strongly, but we've been able to bring health care costs way down. Now, I took over Obamacare, got rid of the individual mandate, made it good, managed it much better. Remember, they had the $5 billion website disaster and all of the problems they had. The problem with Obamacare, it's not good. We'd like to terminate it, and we want a much less expensive health care that's a much better health care, and that's where we're aiming. And if we can do that, and we have a very good chance of doing it, but we've also brought down the price of Obamacare. Problem with Obamacare, it basically is never going to be great. And I want to give great health care.
Mr. So President, important. I got to follow up on the pre-existing conditions. This is such a big issue for voters.
It is a big issue for me, too.
In point of fact, your administration.
And she goes on to say, in point of fact, you're suing right now. And of course, the fact is, just saying we want better and less expensive healthcare. That's not a plan.
Right. Right. That's what he's been able to get away with. That's what used car salesmen, and oh, no offense to used car salesmen, right? But that's what that kind of trope, they're able to sell you anything. And Donald Trump has been able to get away with that type of reasoning or lack of reasoning, this kind of argument for the longest time, because, you know, I don't know how much his supporters actually care that they have had 4 years to give us that healthcare plan and they haven't given us anything. And so I think it's kind of ironic that they're making all these promises in the ninth hour when they had 2 years when they had the House of Representatives, the Senate and the White House, and they had the ability to give us that healthcare plan then, and they haven't done it.
Healthcare seems to be the thing that the Democrats are running on. Again, it was very effective in 2018. They opened up the Amy Coney Barrett hearings talking about the ACA. This general, you know, I mean, the specifics of the ACA, I think, again, we talk about, you know, necessary but inadequate or insufficient. That is a great, I think, a description of the Obamacare, and in many, and at least in the context of making the product decent. On the cost side, I don't think it's really done much, to be honest with you, unless you're eligible for Medicaid, in which case that has been very successful. I think in terms of expansion, hopefully a couple more states will pick it up as well. But give me a sense. I mean, I know you're a former Georgian. You had spent at least a couple of years there. Georgia now has just moved into the sort of lightly shaded blue column, as it were, which is pretty shocking. And Donald Trump is headed there, I think, this weekend for a rally. Give me a sense of, and I know you haven't been there in some time, but in Georgia, like, how does the healthcare play? Like when you got Ossoff and you've got Warnock and they're talking, they're running in these two races. Georgia has two Senate races because of you know, for a whole myriad of reasons, like a special election, they held it off. So Loeffler, how does that play to people there? Just the idea of healthcare, just the healthcare anxiety.
Yeah. When I was there, there were plenty of people, oddly enough. Not oddly enough, I'm sorry, it's the exact opposite. It's the same phenomenon that you see across the country, that a lot of people simply never thought Obamacare was the Affordable Care Act because of, you know, obvious political reasons and bad branding. I think we have to lay some of that at the Obama administration. But when they actually start realizing that there are some key benefits that they actually benefited from directly. You know, we saw that. We saw that in Georgia. I actually have a friend who's still doing some work down there with Black male voters, and they see that very expressly, right? There's one of the reasons Georgia is starting to turn blue is because there's a lot of groundwork that's being done in two specific categories, informing people about the move that the Republicans are making on the Affordable Care Act. First of all, letting them know that the Affordable Care Act is Obamacare, and then pointing out how they have been beneficiaries of the Affordable Care Act and Obamacare. And you would be surprised how many years has Obamacare been around, and they did not realize that the reason that they can keep their 26-year-old on their insurance, the reason that they can keep their child who had pre-existing conditions on their insurance, was because of the Affordable Care Act and Obamacare. So there's just a really tremendous dearth of information. And of course, that's intentional, right? That's been the strategy. And what they've been counting on, they being the Republicans, has been, especially in Georgia, has been to appeal to the pure hatred of Obama. And that hatred kind of blinded a lot of people to the fact that, oh, you're really getting ready to shoot yourself in the foot with the second term of this Republican Party.
You know, it's funny because, and I've said this many times, and I can't even remember what the second half of the, but it, the official name of the Affordable Care Act was the ACA PP. I think it was
Patients Protection.
Yes.
Yeah. Something along those lines.
And I have always said that it was the patient protection side that actually worked. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you put aside the expansion of Medicaid, which I think, you know, only for the sake of this argument, I think it's actually on the balance, probably the best part of the act was the expansion of Medicaid. But in terms of everyone else in the country, it was the PPACA, I guess, Patient Protection Affordable Care Act.
right,
was the actual name of the bill. And they focused on the affordable care part, which was ludicrous because, first off, the affordable care part only applied to either the 10 million people who got Medicaid or the 10 million people who bought it on exchanges. The word affordable was never going to implicate anybody else in the entire country. The PP part of it, the patient protection, that touched everyone.
Right.
That is the part of the bill where, like you say, if you're 26 years old, you're on your parents' thing. It ends rescission. There's no lifetime limits. There's no year-long limits. There's no pre-existing conditions. There are basic aspects of health insurance that you must have to have it considered health insurance, like,
right,
you know, a mammogram or a colonoscopy, that type of thing. And so that was the part that was really, I think, undersold. And that's why I think there was such disillusion with it, because everybody's going around going like, my health insurance is not affordable. It's right. not, you know, the cost curve may have bent in a certain way, but it's still not affordable. You know, that and everybody's walking around going like, it did not deliver, and they don't make the connection between those things.
Yeah, it's got to be, you know, if we get the luxury of going back to a time when we could actually sit down and retrospect, look at the mistakes of a previous administration, right? Because that's a luxury at this point. If we don't give it to Donald Trump, we're not going to have that luxury. But if we ever get that luxury again, we got to sit down and have some courses on the absolute failure in the marketing of the Patient Protection Act, because I think you did more service for the Patients Protection and Affordable Care Act in this last 5 minutes than they did in the entirety of its existence.
Yeah, it is unfortunate. And apparently the unsubsidized ACA exchange population declined by 45% over the past 4 years. Now, a lot of that could have been like no pressure from a mandate, or it could have just been they got priced out, and we, you know, it's hard to assess that, but it's the wrong direction. Right. And so something has to change during the Biden administration that is going to address this. And that is going to be one of those. There's going to be a bunch of jump balls right during this administration if it happens. Now, again, you know, you and I sit here. We can't really know what's happening. We look at the polls, but the big question is, did Donald Trump inspire? And we've seen some data indicating that there's been an increase in registration among non-college educated white people. For the most part, those tend to be Trump voters. And so you and I don't know. I guess the only thing that we can tell people is, you know, go out there, tell your friends, tell your family, tell five people, text a bunch of people, particularly in those swing states, go out, vote. Vote early if you can. But vote, vote, vote. Ben Dixon of the Benjamin Dixon Show. People can find your show where?
Right here on YouTube and everywhere you're streaming for the most part. And they can get the podcast anywhere you find podcasts.
All right, Ben Dixon, appreciate your time. Benjamin Dixon.
Thanks for having me, man.
Folks,
always a pleasure.
Out. All right, well, we are wrapping up our first hour of our program. Again, you know, we are 18 days out. It is very difficult right now to assess the race. We know what the national polls say, but we know what they said last time too. I think at this time, 4 years ago, I was talking to guests who were saying there's about a 99.9% chance that Hillary Clinton will win. I guess it turned out to be closer to 87%. And sometimes those long shots come in. So make sure you go out and vote. We're going to end our first hour and say goodbye to our viewers who are just watching that first hour. We'll see you on Monday. And for those of you who are sticking around, we have a special treat. Let's bring on my old friend, David Rees, first. For those of you who are longtime listeners of this program, long time, super old, you'll remember Get Your War On. This was one of the few means of dissent that we had back in the day during the Iraq War. David Rees now is the co-host, one of the co-hosts of Election Profit Makers. He also is a co-creator of Dicktown on FXX with John Hodgman. And, of course, my new fighting technique is Unstoppable. David Rees, long time no see.
Sam, how are you?
I'm doing great. How are you? What?
Better. Love and life.
Yeah, things going great for you?
Yeah, man. No complaints.
No complaints.
Irie, 420 every day, all day. I thought you had a mustache. I thought you grew a COVID mustache. No,
I did, but I got rid of it. Yeah, I see you did. Oh. You grew yours.
Yeah, something to do. You know, it's good to pick up new hobbies.
Right.
Ivanka Trump was learning how to read Greek or something, and she said this is a great time for everyone to learn new skills. So I thought, all right, I'll try to grow a Greek mustache.
And I'm glad to see that worked out. I was just telling some on the crew that I wish that we had our carpenter pencils that are now available at shop.majorityreportradio.com.
Are you serious?
Back in the day, because you are, of course, I think people will remember, if not the foremost authority on pencil sharpening, maybe the only authority on pencil sharpening in the world.
I would put myself in the top quintile of pencil sharpening experts. Yeah.
But just in the quintile.
I wouldn't say I'm the only expert, no. Thanks to my entrepreneurship-ness, the art and craft of pencil sharpening have never been more popular. Again, it's a great COVID activity. I'm surprised Ivanka Trump didn't suggest it to her Twitter followers. Now's a great time to really learn how to sharpen pencils at home with your children.
It would have been great. It would have been a great thing for her to do, but there's still, sadly, I think, going to be more time as we head into the winter. Well, right. All right. So let's get down to brass tacks. When you're not doing a show, Dicktown, with John Hodgman, you apparently have a podcast that you've revised. Should we bring on your co-host?
Yeah, I feel exposed without my two co-hosts.
Your two co-hosts, Starley Kine and John Kimball, and we'll wait for them to connect. I see Starley's got
here we go.
Starley
coming online.
It's great to have you on. Oh, she didn't hear. Starley, it's great to have you on the show. I listened to Mystery Show.
Murder, She Wrote.
Yeah.
Mystery, She Wrote. Yeah.
Murder, She Podcasted.
I have, it's weird, but when I think about your show, I think of a specific location walking on Flatbush Avenue, because I would walk to work and do that. And,
which part of Flatbush? I love the memories of where I've experienced that too.
It's near the Donut Factory.
Great place to listen to it. Great.
I don't know why that sticks out. And let's bring on your third co-host, John Kimball, who apparently this is the first time he's ever used his webcam. And has not put in his earplugs yet.
He's walking.
This is how the show goes.
This is very much, yes.
All right. Well, Starley,
it's kind of our brand.
Yeah.
Okay. Why don't you tell us about election profit makers while John gets sort of settled here?
Has David told you anything about it?
No, nothing.
He hasn't said a single word about it. We were just talking about pencils. Does John always do this?
Yes.
he's kind of too cool for school.
Yeah.
No, I guess. Okay. Well, let's try and wrap this up before he actually gets plugged in. So Starley, well, tell us about election profit makers, because I know this is like version two of the show, right?
Yeah. Version two, season two. It's the sequel that where we get our revenge.
All right. Well, tell us about the original and then the sequel as well.
Well, we did the first season 17 weeks before the 2016 presidential election. David and John had the idea because John was using Predictit to win money off people who supported Trump, who he thought were fools, and who to be investing money in Trump's victory. And then I guess David had the idea to turn it into a podcast. And he came to me and said, would I help with that? And then we started recording it in my kitchen. We recorded the whole first season in my kitchen. And season two is supposed to be upgrading to getting a studio. And then a pandemic hit. So we're back to recording the podcast in our kitchens.
There you go. Well,
Sam, do you know what Predicted is? Do you trade on Predicted.org?
I have traded on Predicted.org.
Really?
Why don't we let John explain Predicted to us, since he lost so much money last time on
right.
Yeah. So the premise is that we all bet on.
John figured out his computer. How do you guys produce the show every week?
It's a breeze. It's definitely easy, and John always
an image of him just shaking his head like he can't do anything. All right,
John spends 90% of his time on his phone exclusively trading on Predicted.
Yeah.
All right.
And well, so whenever David, he has to use his look laptop, at
this. Charlie's actually taking a picture of how ridiculous this is.
It's like somebody trying to shoot a web video using an abacus. Like when he tries to use his laptop, he completely shuts down.
All right. Well, Matt, please mute his microphone so that we can actually just sort of like extend this out. But David, what is Predicted for people who don't know?
Predicted is an Australian website where people buy and sell shares of political futures, basically news events happening or not happening. It's like a stock market for politics. And the reason that it is allowed legally in the United States is because technically it's an academic study on, I guess, the wisdom of crowds and different ways of forecasting political events.
I mean, so, who believes that?
Well, we do, Sam. We do.
Yeah, we believe it.
You believe that it's an academic exercise?
Sure. Whatever gets you through the night, you know, whatever allows you to, whatever allows you to trade on it. And the other thing is that there's a limit. Any single investor can only put $850 into a single market.
Single bracket
within.
Because I've actually recently realized that I had it wrong this whole time. Because I was betting against.
It takes time to learn.
Decided to join us.
Tim Cook. Computer expert is logged on.
Hey, look, I'm technically proficient in the markets, but not with my computer.
Well, are you technically proficient in the markets, John? My understanding is that you blew like the show, like basically you bankrupt the show, the first version. Is that right?
Yes, that's true. But everybody was wrong in 2016. So, but yes, you're right. I lost a lot of money in 2016. And I'm going to make it all back this time, I'm hoping.
All right. Well, so how does this work? Okay. So, John, since you've decided to join us, how does this, like, okay. So you guys get on your show and you talk about, like, bets that you've made? Like, I'm sorry. How is this, like, what is the value of this to us, John?
So, you know, basically, you know, we started this as a way to deal with our anxiety, but these are tough times, and I think it's a great opportunity.
Oh, my God. John? Have you guys ever been able to produce a single episode of this thing?
No, but
what?
We're really looking forward to recording our first episode.
Politics. I think it's
gonna be
great. Look at now he's sped up. This has never happened. I think maybe you guys. All right. So, like, David, why don't you explain to us now?
Okay, let's take it again.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Sam, I understand your skepticism. I totally get where you're coming from. It's a great question. I'd be happy to answer it.
Well, thank you.
No.
Basically, it's a show about the state of the world and politics where the lens through which we talk about all this stuff is our portfolio on predictit.org. Mm-hmm. So we do a lot of the same stuff that a lot of, you know, center left to hard left podcasts do. We make fun of politicians. We gripe and we groan about the state of the world. We think the president is a big dummy. Sometimes we're less than enthusiastic about the Biden campaign. But throughout all of those, you know, wonderful conversations that we're having to the delight and amusement of all, we're also literally putting our money where our mouth is. Unlike most pundits who never actually pay a price for being catastrophically wrong. Mm. You might remember this, Sam, from the days of the Iraq War. As long as we're taking a trip way back machine, people can get things stupendously wrong and still keep their jobs and suffer no consequences. Mm. So one of the points of election profit makers was, all right, we don't know much, we don't know any more or less than any other pundit. We can all talk out of our asses like pundits, but at the very least, let's have the integrity to actually suffer if we get things wrong. So for instance, on the night of the 2016 election, like John said, just about everybody called that wrong. The difference was that cumulative, we lost thousands of dollars on that night, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Whereas Wolf Blitzer probably went home and slept like a baby. At least we had the integrity to lose a bunch of money.
And people are profiting off politics every day. And we're living in this capitalist society where everyone's just making money off of running, being president or showing the president nonstop. So at least we like, it's actually, I feel like the purest way to engage, to engage with that.
It's creating a greater stakes, but on a day-to-day basis, John, if you're here with us now,
I think I am.
Do you guys, is it just like, you're just going to pay the price on election day? Or are you guys doing like, by September 1, the polls are going to be like this, or, I mean, and are you doing other races?
He froze again.
John's in the past. Oh, damn.
Oh, my God. All right, just put a image.
Sorry.
Starley,
So I feel that I feel like the smart – John has all these ways where he's betting on it. He's hedging and he's betting. No matter if whoever wins, he's going to not lose money again somehow. I feel like I'm back to where I was last time where all of my money is just tied up in whether Trump loses. Like, Yeah.
So, David, are you guys, do you necessarily have to bet a certain amount each week? Is that what's going on?
No.
David bets pennies.
I'm a real spendthrift. I don't have a lot of liquid assets right now. So I don't have nearly as much invested in the market as Starley or John. I think John has thousands of dollars. We have one listener who I know has, you know, almost $40,000 invested across all of predictit.org. Some of the markets will resolve the morning after the election if all goes according to plan. Some of the markets resolve at the end of a week if it comes down to polling numbers. And then obviously, just like the stock market, you can buy and sell shares whenever you want. It's just a matter of somebody meeting your ask price. So for instance, months and months ago, I went long on Jamie Harrison beating Lindsey Graham. Mm-hmm. I just had a good feeling and I thought it would be fun to throw some dollars down the wishing well against Lindsey Graham. And, you know, it was looking like a good investment for a while. It was moving up and up. But recently, I think in the last, maybe it's the power of Dianne Feinstein hugging Lindsey Graham and legitimizing the Amy Coney Barrett hearings. But now I'm underwater on Jamie Harrison. And I'm kind of thinking like, I don't know, maybe it's time to sell. Like, just get out and eat the loss. You don't have to wait until the election to...
And you can also hedge. Like, I have all this money tied up in how if Biden were to win, how many electoral college margin he would win by. It all hinges on him still winning. But I have like money, and it's so cheap right now that I have money in all the different bunch of different markets.
And you guys, in the meantime, are also raising money for organizations that are helping get people to the polls, right?
Yeah, that was not the point of the podcast. That was kind of something we stumbled into. So sometimes during the course of the podcast, I'll get really frustrated with a listener. Maybe someone is sending us too many emails or something, and I will, like, quote unquote, ban that listener. And they're forbidden from listening to the podcast. And about a month and a half ago, there were quite a few listeners that I had banned. And then somebody was complaining about how I was being mean about Nancy Pelosi. And I said, okay, I'm going to be more positive from now until the end of the election. And David Graeber had just died. I don't know if you knew him, Sam. But, you know, he was involved with Astra Taylor and some other folks in the Rolling Jubilee, where they were getting rid of medical debt and, you know, all that stuff. And that was a project I had been involved in. So I said, okay, in the honor of David Graeber, we're going to have a ban jubilee. This is a big tent now. Everyone is welcome. I'm rescinding and canceling all listener bans. Everyone can listen to our wonderful podcast. Let's just get across the finish line. Then I got an email from a listener who was mad that we had forgiven all the bans because he really wanted us to ban his friend. So I said to this listener, all right, give whatever, $50 to fairfight.org and I'll ban your friend live on the air. Like an old school, like radio request, you know, long distance dedication. And then it spiraled out of control and people started writing in and donating money and asking that we ban people. Like brothers banning brothers and parents banning children and children banning parents and all this kind of stuff. Somebody banned Bruno Mars from listening because I hate Mars because of its association with Elon Musk. Like, people have been doing a lot of really creative bans.
Yeah,
and initially we thought it was going to raise like $500, but now as of this week, we're over $20,000.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Which, so it started as a goof and then it kind of spiraled out of control. And now all day, all I do is read these bans and try to rewrite these ban dedications so that the shows aren't 4 hours long.
And the first season, Starley, you have no listeners practically, right? Because they've all been banned.
Yeah, that's the goal. The goal is to have to be the only podcast that has no listeners at the end of its run.
Zero listeners by election night, zero hosts. That's our goal.
No, but we can't.
Help us.
I feel like John has already got a jump on both of you.
Maybe he got a fat donation that we don't know about and he's self-banning. And this is just his spectacular self-ban.
It would take a lot to silence. It would take a lot to ban. We've all so many people have put money in to protect us from being banned.
Oh, that's true. You can also donate to protect, like someone donated $1,000 to protect Starley from being banned.
Mm-hmm. So, by whom? Do you have the authority to ban your fellow co-hosts?
They could have banned me, or a listener could have banned. But we now have layers of protection because they keep giving more money to protect us from some clever.
How much did it cost to ban John's internet connection?
That might have just been an executive decision by Comcast. Mm-hmm. They might just be like throttling him. You know how social media is shutting down conservative voices and free thought?
Yes.
This might be somebody retaliating against John Kimball.
Centrist Kimball.
Someone wants to shut down neoliberal centrist thought, mm-hmm. and they're sabotaging his internet.
He's frozen again.
No.
Yeah.
Oh, there we go.
He's frozen, but speaking.
His image is frozen. He's or either that, or he's doing like some ventriloquism. That's pretty good. I didn't even see your mouth.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I'm so sorry.
Right now.
Yeah.
Loving life right now. Sam, we'll tell you.
Definitely
it's a
not
great
his
podcast.
Biggest nightmare.
There's definitely no technical issues. It's a lot of fun. We all speak and can communicate clearly with each other when we're firing on all cylinders. And,
So how are you guys recording it? Is it basically like this, except for theoretically you're all connected?
What we do is we use Zoom and we also use our microphones and we have GarageBand, not to brag, but most of us use GarageBand.
I use Pro Tools.
Oh, right.
See, so you guys record on your own ends and then
it all gets synced. We go to time.is and we all clap at a certain time. I don't know if you folks do that at the Majority Report.
What is it called?
Time.is. It's a wonderful internet clock, and everyone is seeing the same time at the same, you know, at the time, so to speak. And they'll say, "Okay, at 12:35:05, everybody clap," and then you can sync up your audio. It's like a slate.
Oh, interesting! It's interesting. I hope it works better than this, because that must take a lot of editing work to do.
Oh my God, John is no. So John and I have known each other since seventh grade. We've been friends for over 35 years. And this experience today on the Majority Report, I'm so happy because I know I can ride this basically until retirement age.
Right. You're going to have
John
this.
John is never going to live this down. His triumphant debut on the Majority Report.
This is going to be
Marcel Marceau in effect. Just like.
So now, wait a second. So what happens? Is the show over on November? I mean, maybe it's November 3rd, but maybe it's November 5th or November 8th or what happens?
So the season one, like Starley mentioned, we recorded our last episode the morning after the election. That was our final episode. And that was just a great, fun episode that I
bet you that must have been so much fun for you guys.
I would love to re-listen to that episode. I think I was like literally sobbing on the microphone.
Yeah.
This season, I kind of want to go at least until Biden's inauguration, because I actually think the crazy zone is actually, let's assume Trump loses. I think the real crazy stuff that's going to happen is that dead space, you know, between the election and the inauguration.
Yeah.
Because then Trump, like, there's literally nothing I can't imagine Trump doing in those couple months, just out of spite or for financial gain.
And the show that will be put on, like the amount of crazy we're going to be subjected to and hearing him say, it'll be, I think a lot of people, it's interesting. Like the last time, you know, Trump got COVID, the debates happened and then he got COVID. And so that happened so fast that we actually never talked about that debate on the show. And some people have written to us and been like, I didn't get a chance to process that debate because you didn't cover it. And I think that is sometimes the role of the show, that people need to hear it being discussed. Because it's not like we come out, it's not even like it comes out right as the events are happening. And I feel like that a period between the election and the inauguration, we're going to be, first of all, processing a lot of trauma. And they're going to be, gloves will be off, and that seems to will be needed. All needed
in the event that that Donald Trump loses.
Right. Well, I mean, yeah.
I mean, that's the thing, right? I mean, it's almost impossible. On one hand, I don't want to entertain the idea of Trump losing because I don't want to get ahead of myself too much. Although, you know, Ben Dixon and I were talking about, from a political standpoint, the fight to influence the transition and the first couple of years of a Biden administration. And I think that's worthwhile to do. But like, I'm not letting myself go to that place where it's like I'm even thinking about sort of secondary aspects of it.
Right.
Yeah. But the place that I cannot go, that I have been completely unable to access, and I don't see any even, I don't even see any value in it on some level, is registration of non-college white guys in Michigan and Wisconsin and Pennsylvania is up, and Donald Trump wins by 20,000 in Pennsylvania and 5,000 in Wisconsin and 4,000 in Michigan or something like that.
And wins a popular vote or something like that.
Oh yeah. Yeah. No, I think Joe Biden wins the popular vote. I don't think that's, I think that's almost impossible to imagine any other scenario, but like, I have not been able to even contemplate the scenario of Trump winning. Like, it's just too disturbing on some level. Like, I don't even know where you start with something like that.
Yeah. Yeah, it's weird though, because it feels like we can't, there's no, you can't contemplate that happening, but there's also like, you can't speak about Trump losing, because then it all feels like jinxy. It's very hard we've talked about this. It's like a totally different feeling than last time, where all you were doing was talking about how it was like the election was coming and there was constant coverage. I mean, there's constant coverage now, but now it's like, it's almost, as it gets so close, you almost don't want to speak about it at all because you can't entertain if it goes wrong and you are afraid to hope for it to go right.
How much of the show is, I mean, when you guys started this out, how much of it was also to sort of expose just the enormous amount of money? I mean, I guess you mentioned this a little bit up front, but it just the enormous amount of money that is generated off this. And I, you know, obviously, like, it's an indictment on some level of what I do too, right? Like, this is the way I am, not necessarily just election profit making, but I am, you know, politics profit making. I'm like a barnacle on, you know, the good ship, I guess, or the sinking ship of American
body politics. Right.
That's why we always manage to never make any money. So at least we have that.
Integrity wins again. Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I feel, I mean,
haplessly.
I don't feel nearly as cynical or disgusted by like the left-wing podcast industry as I do with, you know, cable news. I mean, the money is just, there's no comparison, right? And I think even the biggest political podcasts are absolutely probably, this is just me talking with no knowledge, but the biggest political podcasts are probably absolutely dwarfed by the smallest political TV shows.
You know, when you're talking someone like even like Tim Pool, I'm willing to wager that Tim Pool generates more revenue on his show than the vast majority of cable news talkers make.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. You're the Tim Pool, your debate partner, your buddy.
We're having a little bit of the miscommunication,
logistical issues
as of late. We're getting, but I mean, I think there are people out there, I mean, who are making that kind of money in this space. I mean, he is, I think, sort of particularly, you know, I mean, Joe Rogan, I wouldn't call him a political podcaster, but
right.
He's got influence.
And he operates in that space to some extent, and he makes, you know, a huge multi-million dollar deals. So, David, let me ask you this, just because you and I first met in 2004 or 2005, I guess, and it was in the context, I think, of Get Your War On. Certainly,
Air America Day, speaking of incredibly financially lucrative media outlets.
Yes, that crashed and burned.
We're on Air America.
Give me your sense of comparing that era to this one.
Bush versus Trump. Who is the worst president? That type of stuff?
Well, no, I'm not even talking about Bush and Trump. I'm talking more about one of the things that I've noticed, or that I noticed through this year through the Trump years is, obviously I left comedy, joined Janine to do the original Majority Report and thought it was going to be temporary. And I like this. I found this a little bit more fulfilling in many respects, but we both had friends and agents and managers and other comedians who are like, what are you doing? why are you doing this? Why are you so strong? I remember going to dinner parties and just not many, I didn't get invited to many, but to the extent that I would get invited to a dinner party, and somebody would say we would be talking about something, and then I would just basically vomit over the table all of this horrible things that George Bush was doing in the Iraq
War.
Actually,
the Downing Street memo proves conclusively that Tony Blair was complicit in the...
But it was also the Clean Air Act, whatever it was.
Right.
And people would just look at me like, what is wrong with you, man? And this era, it's almost the opposite dynamic, where all of those people who are like, what are you doing with your life, are texting me like, did you see this? I don't go anywhere where people don't have at least, some measure of parity or more knowledge of what's going on than I do. Right. And it's completely flipped. And you were at least, you were a constant critic of that era through Get Your War On. And I, obviously it's a little bit different because you're not, sitting there and doing the strip at a dinner party and people are going like, hey, David, could you put away your, uh-huh. Could you not do that here?
Right.
But I'm just curious that, what do you make of that?
I think it's a great example of how actual personality and politics actually matters. I think I've learned a couple things from the Trump presidency, or I've learned things, and what I mean by that is I've realized that I had some fundamental assumptions about politics that were completely mistaken. Back in the Bush administration, during the Iraq War, post 9/11 era, when I was doing the cartoon, I really had kind of a Noam Chomsky view of it. Sometimes when you read Noam Chomsky, it's this kind of bloodless analytical attitude of the personalities of politicians don't matter. This all comes down to states exercising power and realpolitik, and who's in charge doesn't matter because these are fundamental forces about self-interest that will just grind innocent people and spit them out the other end.
Snowpiercer model.
I used to really, really believe that. And then with Trump, I feel like he's just so disgusting. He's just such a tacky, cruel, hateful, ignorant asshole that I think a lot of people, that's the hook for a lot of people. And then they're so appalled by his personality and his behavior that then his policies are seen immediately as a reflection of that depravity, right? And so I do think, I don't want to be one of those people who's like, hey, Obama actually droned innocent people too. Like he did, but there's no comparison to Trump. But I do believe that if Trump was a quote unquote regular Republican and was doing all this stuff, people would be less engaged because, he wouldn't just be so disgusting about it. Right. I do think the personality is a hook and that engages people in the politics. And I guess in the end, I guess that's what this election comes down to. Right.
I think 90. I'm just pulling this number out of my arse, but I think 90% of the voting population is basically just going on cues, what is blue, what is red, what's associated with this cultural signifier, what's so, and then to the extent that there's a jump ball here, it's just like Joe Biden just seems nice.
Right.
And yeah. And right. Donald Trump seems like a jerk.
Right. I'm just tired.
Or he seems so unhinged that I think there's some people that are being peeled off that are just like this. He's actually feeling dangerous in a way that.
Unhinged.
Know. Yeah.
Relentless. Yeah. In my face.
He's worn people down.
Things more than right. I want to. I mean, yeah. That whole, it's basically coming down to like Trump is just too much of something. Yeah. And Joe Biden just seems to be, you know, fine.
Right. Yeah.
And I think I think there's a chance if the pandemic hadn't happened, that wouldn't have been the case. We've just been confined to these screens and we've just had to watch Trump so much, and Biden pulling away means that he represents peace and quiet in a way that Trump doesn't. And we crave it.
Right. Right.
I think that's true. I think also just from a an operating standpoint, it's a different. I mean, there's a whole myriad of other things. But I think, yes, it scares me to have I'm still scared of the election anyways. But it makes me very nervous to contemplate Joe Biden having been the nominee without coronavirus, because yes. I'm not convinced. You could defer so completely to the idea of this being a referendum on Donald Trump.
Yes.
In other words, you would have to show up with something that, you know, beyond you're not even going to know I'm here.
You wouldn't have the body count, and it's a body count that you didn't get from a war, which probably would have helped Trump somehow.
Yeah. Right.
Like
yeah.
you just have, what you can confront him with, no one can look away from.
To be honest with you, I am a little bit surprised at this point that we have not bombed Iran. I mean, we still have 2 weeks left, but I would have thought by October 16th, if you had told me that Donald Trump was down by 10, mm-hmm. that there would be more drastic measures being taken by him by now. I think we just saw one the other day where, you know, Rudy Giuliani somehow got a hold of a computer that somebody dropped off at a computer repair store and never came back for. That's the part of the story that I'm sort of like, I haven't quite dug out. Like, who's the guy who drops off the computer at a computer store? Like, you care enough about, like, I can understand, like, oh, I can't figure out how to get, you know, I can't find my mail. Well, I'm going to throw out the computer. Like, I can imagine like somebody doing that. Like this computer's got such malware. I can, you know, like my parents always say that. Like
it's like an 11-year-old's version of a John le Carré novel.
Yeah.
Right. But then like who goes and drops off their computer at a computer repair shop and then just like, forget it. I don't need it.
Yeah.
I took all that time to take it down there, but I don't need it.
I feel like I kind of do that sometimes. I have done that.
Have you?
I feel like there's been times when like there's something that I remember having like a camera that I wanted to get fixed, but I didn't really want the camera that much. I barely had the energy to take it in to get fixed. And it's kind of a way of getting rid of the things in your life that you feel bummed.
You used it as a storage facility, basically. The repair.
Yeah. and trash. But I couldn't quite bring myself to throw it away.
Did you leave the film in it with the horrible compromising pictures of you?
Oh, right. With with Burisma people?
Yeah. Maybe not that.
But Sam, I think what you're talking about is like, he only really has one mode. And so they're just trying everything that worked in 2016. And I think it's probably driving.
They also ran out of time. And it also seemed like they just couldn't get it together in time. I mean, the coronavirus, him getting COVID was a curveball. And so who knows what they had planned otherwise for these.
Yeah, that's true.
Good point. Well, guys, the podcast sounds like a lot of fun. I think I'm going to go to Predict It and try and make a ton of cash.
Biden is trading at 65 cents on Predict It right now, Sam. Do you think that's a fair price?
Yeah. Okay. I was going to ask you that. I don't know what that means. Like, so what does that mean? Like as opposed to like $1.65 or as opposed
to $1? Every position ranges from 1 cent to 99 cents.
Okay,
and you buy shares, and if it comes out yes, you're paid out $1. So right now, this means that according to the collective wisdom of Predict It, there's a 65% chance that Biden will win the election because he's trading at 65 cents.
But Trump, is trading at 60 cents.
Right. So it's sometimes there's a little arbitrage.
So it's even low. It's,
mismatch there.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, I think at 65 cents, that seems like a fair price. I mean, I would be a little more interested at 60 cents with Biden, but okay. You know, it's very hard. This is why, like, I'm not good at these things because I cannot pull out my aspirations from my analysis in that regard or my fears, frankly.
This is one of the big tensions of our podcast is whether we treat predict it as an investment strategy or a wishing well.
Mm-hmm.
And
right.
Starley, over the course of this season, has switched. She used to only bet with her heart, and now mm-hmm. she's become a complete neo-lib capitalist robot who only cares about her portfolio, and she spends all this time on like the electoral college margin of victory market.
Yeah, except I still don't ever vote for Trump winning. I can't bring myself to do that.
Well, right. I mean, that's part of the problem. I was saying to Ben Dixon earlier was just like, you know, we can look at the polls. You can look at the polls even in the swing states where the electoral college is. But what we cannot tell is how to factor in these voter registration numbers. Mm-hmm. And we cannot, you know, because there is no doubt in my mind, the election is going to come down to a similarly tiny group of people. We don't know how effective, like, look, Pennsylvania, there's a story today about 360,000 absentee ballots that got confused. I mean, I can't even make out, like, everybody seems to be completely befuddled by the whole thing. And you just don't know. Like, Hillary Clinton lost by 40,000 votes. So when you're talking about 360,000 ballots that are going out, like, you know, the idea that the election can rest upon things that are almost immeasurable at this point seems to me to be very likely. And, you know, with all due respect to predict it, you guys worship at the altar of a gambling platform.
Use your words very carefully, Sam. We're very, very touchy about how people talk about predict it.
That requires an assumption that there is enough available information that people could even aggregate to make that assessment. And I don't think there is. I just don't think that there are so many factors, particularly this time around, and maybe in general, when you're talking about races that are this close, that there is enough information out there to make a genuine, rational assessment. And so I would say, yes.
Are you talking about known unknowns right now? Are you quoting Donald Rumsfeld? You're channeling Donald Rumsfeld, right? There's a lot of known unknowns.
We do might even no. Be some we don't know.
Unknowns.
We know the unknowns, but there are some unknowns we don't that are also unknown.
Right, the unknown unknowns.
I think there's going to be literally people who don't take their ballots in. That was what I thought about the other day. Like, I have my ballot in my house. I'll go drop it off. Don't you think there's going to be like some people who are just too mean to vote and the number of steps it's going to take this time.
I can tell you this, that my junior year of college, I ran for student government president, and John Benjamin, one of my closest friends, well, probably my closest friend in my life, forgot to vote for me. And I lost by like 5 or 6 votes.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
So
you didn't get that to be a lesson for any you. Supreme Court college justices. Because of that loss. Mm-hmm.
That's right.
You weren't
I did not have the ability to influence the Judiciary Board that Damn year. It was, let me just say this, John, it was great to meet you. John Kimball, I've heard so much about you, and to have this opportunity to talk to you has been great. Starley, great to meet you. And David, wonderful to see you again. Folks can find Election Profit Makers on, I imagine, just about any podcast platform.
Yeah, absolutely, Sam.
Yeah, that's how it works, I think. Yeah.
All right, well, we put a link to one of those platforms.
Okay, thank you.
At Majority.fm.
We appreciate
Thanks, guys.
That.
Really appreciate it.
Great
it was fun
to see you,
talk
Sam.
To you.
Take care.
Yeah.
All right.
Bye.
All right, folks. Going to head into the fun half of the program, wherein we will have fun. And I guess we will take your phone calls. We... Disco Stu says, considering Biden is up 10 in the national polls, can we really envision a scenario where that number was higher? This sounds crazy, but maybe he's running a decent campaign. I mean, I think he is running the best campaign that Joe Biden can run. Let's put it that way. And what is relevant, though, is the Electoral College at the end of the day. And what is relevant is, you know, where he's running well. And, you know, it appears that he is. But we will see. We're going to take a break. We'll take some phone calls. I see our calls have filled up. And again, just a reminder, your support makes this show possible. Join themajorityreport.com. Next week's going to be another crazy week. We'll be here 5 days of next week. In addition to covering the debate Thursday night, I don't know what else to tell you, folks. Don't forget, check out Nomi's show today at 3. Check out Jamie's show, The Intifada, patreon.com/TheIntifada. Matt, TMBS this week?
Yeah, Sunday we'll have a think tank for patrons, so look forward to that. I'm going to talk about the Mi'kmaq, I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right, but Native Americans in Nova Scotia who are having some troubles with commercial fishermen up there. It's really crazy stuff. They're literally destroying property because Indigenous people are fishing as allowed by, you know, the treaties and Canadian law. So we'll be talking about that on Sunday for patrons. Patreon.com/TMBS.
All right, folks. 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
RM for it.
All right, folks. 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half. Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back. Back, 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 back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back, back.
Just as delicious as you can imagine.
The alpha males are back, 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 back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back, 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 back.
Just want to degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back, back.
I take all of it in my throat.
Alpha males are back.
Almost has what?
The alpha males are back, 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 back.
You are a madman!
And the alpha males are back, back, back.
I am a total cunt.
Can we bring back DJ Dannerke's song, please?
Yeah, or a couple of them. Just put them in rotation.
DJ Dannerke.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough of a break.
That's fucking nonsense.
Hey, fuck! Reminder!
I do not have Parkinson's.
And the alpha males are
psych. Fuck them. Fuck them.
Almost says what?
What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What?
What? What? What?
What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What?
Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black Africans. And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black.
Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keep it at 100. Can't knock the hustle.
Come on!
Fuck them. Fuck them. Fuck them. Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday!
My birthday!
Happy birthday to me, Jew boy!
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black. Alpha males are back, back. Africans are black.
Come on! Someone needs to pay the price for blasphemy around here!
pussy, 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 pussy